Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on Kebu Community Radio, where the time is 22 minutes before 8 o'clock. And the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. This morning, this is another in our series of special programs, the Whole Communities Radio Project, and this is actually a reunion show, because exactly a year ago, I had two of these same people on, and which is Mike Houck, who is with the Urban Green Spaces Institute and Portland Audubon Society, and Bob Salinger, who is also with Portland Audubon Society, and then Michelle Boussard, who is with Johnson Creek Watershed Council, and she's actually standing in for the person last year who would have represented Johnson Creek was Steve Johnson. So this is our new member to the reunion. But we did a program just a year ago about the importance of natural spaces and green spaces in the city. And this year we're going to be looking at a more specific part of that topic, which is all the disappeared creeks that are underneath the streets of Portland. And we're going to be talking about the importance, again, of preserving natural spaces in the city, specifically looking at how to restore the watersheds in Portland to look like some kind of semblance of what they need to be. So first of all, I want to welcome everybody. Good morning, Bob, Mike, and Michelle. And before we start our conversation, we're going to have a feature produced by one of the Whole Communities Radio Project trainees, Kayleen Chassie, a piece called Water.
Portland, Oregon is a city surrounded by two mighty rivers, the Willamette and the Columbia. It is also a city built on creeks. As this town grew into its city self, it buried more and more miles of creeks by building massive infrastructure on top of them. How do urban creeks and streams affect the health of rivers, wildlife, and people? Mike Houck with the Urban Green Spaces Institute has been an advocate for protecting nature in the city. I asked him about the importance of streams in the urban environment.
They form the most significant element of the ribbons of green, the green infrastructure system of the city. They carry floodwaters to the larger system of rivers, the Willamette and the Columbia River. There's no other element of the landscape that's as rich in diversity of plant, fish, and other animal life than stream corridors.
Historically, there were a tremendous number of streams in Portland.
Bob Salinger is the Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society.
This really is correctly named the River City, and the tributaries of the Willamette were extensive on both sides of the river, but many, many of them have been put underground into culverts. Today we have over 388 miles of streams in culverts in the metropolitan region.
Metro, in collaboration with the Bureau of Environmental Services here in Portland, produced a map called the Disappearing Streams Map, which shows some 400 miles of streams running underground in the Portland metropolitan area and the region. Mike Houck.
When people see and realize how many miles of streams we put underground, they say, oh my God, I had no idea that streams were there in the past. This is particularly true for the Columbia Slough. I also have not encountered a single issue that strikes the imagination of the general public as the whole concept of daylighting streams, bringing them above ground and exposing them to the urban environment.
What would it look like if more streams that once meandered through the city were allowed to breathe again? When the Pearl District was being developed, engineers seriously considered daylighting Tanner Creek, which runs off the West Hills near the zoo, down the Tualatin Mountains, and through the Pearl District. It was decided it just wasn't feasible, and what got built in its place were Jameson Square and Tanner Springs Park. Mike Houck.
That water that's ebbing and flowing represents the fact that there is a stream underground there.
Although parks such as Jameson Square, with its creatively designed water fountain features, can evoke the energies of water on the surface that we interact with in the urban environment, it still isn't a natural, free-flowing body of water. But you don't have to hang out in culverts to experience some of Portland's creeks. Balch Creek in Forest Park and Johnson Creek, which flows along much of the Springwater Corridor Trail, are two creeks you can visit. Michelle Boussard, Executive Director of the Johnson Creek Watershed Council.
Johnson Creek meanders 26 miles from its headwaters near Boring through a very rural countryside through and into a more densely populated floodplain and then on into Portland to the confluence with the Willamette at Milwaukee. We've got salmon that are returning, migrating, and spawning. Johnson Creek is one of the last free-flowing streams within the Portland metropolitan area, which is to say we don't have as many traditional daylighting issues as other creeks might have. The bigger issue for Johnson Creek are what we would traditionally call fish passage barriers. These are dams and culverts.
Talk to the mic.
Portland is lucky to have some urban streams still above ground.
Mike is talking.
One
beneficial
function that stream corridors provide is critical habitat for birds, fish, and other wildlife.
We've got a very robust lamprey eel population, which was considered for ESA, Endangered Species Act listing.
Mike, talk some more.
The lamprey eel was traditionally an ancient food source for Native Americans that traveled this watershed. In addition to that, we know that we've got coyote, deer, possum, raccoon, a lot of animals that have been able to adapt to human behaviors.
We know that creeks and streams aid in the absorption of stormwater, providing natural and free ways to deal with urban runoff. Green infrastructure has economic benefits. Right now, the city of Portland is spending over $1 billion on the Big Pipe. Bob Salinger, Portland Audubon Society.
The Big Pipe is the largest works project in the history of Oregon, and what this essentially deals with is the fact that we have raw sewage in our rivers. It's not that big of a pipe, and the reality is if we don't start dealing with stormwater on site, things like daylighting creeks, putting in bioswales, roof gardens, increasing our tree canopy, the Big Pipe will be obsolete within a generation or two. And if we don't learn to develop cities in a way that's ecologically sensitive, we're going to continue to see species decline. Stream corridors are, without question, the most biologically rich areas of any environment.
Will the city hold on to its existing green infrastructure? And will it put creative ideas, energy, and monies into recreating more? Right now, there's an underground network of waterways flowing beneath us, out of sight, but it doesn't need to be out of mind. For the Whole Communities Radio Project, this is Kayleen Chassie.
What is this black line running through my mind? Well, it's the Willamette River, a dark, muddy river. Oh, the Willamette River, a dark, muddy river.
And now we're back in the studio with Bob Salinger, who is the Urban Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland, Mike Houck, who was the original urban naturalist for the Audubon Society of Portland and now has his own organization called the Urban Green Spaces Institute, and Michelle Boussard, who is the executive director for the Johnson Creek Watershed Council. And these are all voices that you've just heard on Kayleen's piece, except we've taken Bob out of that echo tunnel that he was in. And the character we don't have with us is the hawk. Now, why didn't you bring your hawk, Bob?
You didn't ask me to bring it this morning.
Okay. Next time.
Next time, we'll bring a hawk. And a peregrine.
Okay. And actually, there were some really fine sounds in that piece, and I think it gives us a sense of all the amazing nature that exists in the city. Though I think the hawk actually was inside the Audubon office. Is that true?
That's correct, as was the peregrine.
Yeah, I noticed they had the same echo that you had. So anyway, we're going to talk today about some of these creeks that are that have disappeared. They sort of like, I guess, many countries have their disappeared political prisoners, and in the United States we have our disappeared creeks. I think I imagine they have them all over the world, actually. I was told, actually, Mike, by Steve Johnson, who's not with us today, that you have a group, is it called the Wild Turkeys or something like that? And you go around and you look for the disappeared creeks. I wonder if you could tell us about some of the adventures you've had and where you found some of these creeks.
Well, the most interesting one was Alder Creek, as I recall. It flows beneath the bowling alley on Southeast Morrison, I think it is. And if you crawl down the manhole cover, take the manhole cover off and crawl down the ladder in front of Produce Row, you can actually see Alder Creek, and you can see where it enters the Willamette River from underground. So yeah, we explored that whole watershed one day.
So did you actually go into down the manhole cover and walk along the creek bed?
We didn't walk. We simply climbed down the ladder just to take a peek out to the Willamette River. So
now, I heard some other stories. I'm not sure if you want to talk about them on the air, about your adventures of looking for Alder Creek. I think actually some of the adventures happened in that bowling alley.
Oh, you mean in the restroom?
Yeah. Yes.
We traced the origin of some portion of Alder Creek's hydrologic connection through the restrooms in the bowling alley. That's true.
And I understand you surprised somebody. So what is the point, though, of doing that? I mean, what do you find when you look down some of the manhole covers? I was taken by Bill Bakke a few years ago to follow the route of Markham Creek, and he took me to a manhole cover. We didn't go down there, but I stuck my microphone right in like one of the little holes in the manhole cover, and you could hear this creek roaring about 200 feet below ground level. So what are we learning about, like, what is here beneath our feet?
Well, I just think it points out the fact that we have altered the landscape very dramatically as we've built the city. And Corbett-Twilliger-Lair Hill neighborhood is another good example. If you walk along southwest Corbett, you can hear those streams that come off the West Hills through that neighborhood and into the river as well. And it's just as evocative, I guess, of what the landscape was prior to settlement.
Actually, there's some places where I think some of those creeks have escaped. I remember the old Natures on Corbett when you there's like a gravel road that's just north of that building. And I went there many times in my life. And you had to kind of be careful as you cross this little creek in order to get into the store.
Right.
And I don't know if that's a seep or actually it was part of an actual creek. But it always amazed me that this water was running. It was a 12-month year creek that was running right down the street, right into Corbett. And I guess it runs into a storm sewer and into the river.
Correct.
And then another one that I find interesting in Selwood Riverfront Park, there's a little bit of a stream that goes along the sidewalk that heads towards the river, right close to the riverbank. And I've been watching that for years and like wondering, like they did all this landscaping there a number of years ago, but they didn't seem to be able to control this little trickle of water, which during the flood then sort of helped to fill that whole park with water. So, Bob, let's talk a little bit about how the culverted creeks in our town affect your work in terms of protecting wildlife in the city.
Well, as was mentioned in the introduction, these stream corridors are the most biologically rich areas we have. And so when we talk about wildlife habitat in the city, when we talk about connectivity of wildlife habitat, it's really critical. And that's why one of the reasons we focus on those kinds of areas in terms of protection. But it also has many other benefits, flood control, water quality, just a great deal of use for the public, and also access to nature. These are areas, when we put streams underground, we deny the populace access to nature and opportunity to interact with birds and wildlife and trees and water. From a variety of different perspectives, it's really critical that we protect these areas and daylight them where we can.
Well, I'm actually thinking, you mentioned flood control, and part of that series is probably a tributary stream to Alder Creek. Doesn't it run into Southeast 40th Street in the Belmont-Hawthorne area? And I know a number of people who live along that way who in 96 spent a very stressful week pumping their basements out because that creek was running through their houses. There are all these creeks that are underground that are supposedly tamed in tubes, but what happens when we have a major flood event?
Well, what we don't have is the capacity to really contain those flood events. We've put these streams into culverts. We've put up walls around some of the creeks that are still above ground. And what happens is instead of having floodplains where the water can spread out and follow its natural course in a flood event. Instead, what we have is a situation where it goes over the banks or comes out of the pipes and floods into our neighborhoods, into our businesses. The other thing that happens is we combine sewer overflows where our sewage mixes with stormwater, and in those events, the sewage goes directly into the river.
Well, speaking of flood events, let's talk about Johnson Creek. Michelle Bouchard is the executive director of the Johnson Creek Watershed Council. And when I came here in 1971, actually, and it was a very rainy year, it was a high water year, my first year in Portland, and I started hearing about this place, Johnson Creek, and it just sounded like it was the scourge of Portland. It was the two things that were said about Johnson Creek that I picked up immediately as a new resident of Portland was flooding and pollution. So let's talk about flooding, and then let's talk about what you've done with pollution. But let's talk first a little bit about Johnson Creek's history of flooding and why it floods so badly.
The reason Johnson Creek floods so badly really goes back to 1934 and 1935 when the Works Progress Administration created a trapezoidal channel out of Johnson Creek, thinking that that would...
What does that mean?
It means they lined it with rock, beautifully done. I mean, the workmanship is unparalleled for its beauty, unfortunately. But within that beauty was the scourge of Johnson Creek, because once they created this rock-lined channel, instead of doing what it was supposed to do, it simply created a faster pathway for the water to rush through the watershed. I kind of compare it to the difference to traveling down I-5 at 70 miles an hour to get to your destination and getting there, you know, rushed and harried, and but you're there, versus what we would prefer to see, which is a trip that meanders through the back roads and you get to enjoy the wildlife and the birds and the country homes.
Ideally on your bicycle, right?
Ideally on your bicycle. But we don't have that at Johnson Creek. And the reason we don't have that kind of a meandering creek is because of this early on interference with the natural flow of the creek.
Now, just to interject, how long, I mean, Johnson Creek starts up in Boring.
It starts up in Boring, 26 miles main stem.
Now, how far down from its headwaters does this trapezoidal channel start?
We've been able to track it, it probably starts somewhere in the Lentz area. I don't exactly know exactly where it starts, but a good 12 to 16 miles of the main stem were channelized, as well as some of the tributaries. You can see the rock wall on Arrow Creek in some parts as well. And the other piece that happened, speaking of disappearing creeks, is in the 1930s, there were probably 30 or more creek systems within the Johnson Creek watershed that were free-flowing. And due to development, those were all eventually covered up. That also added to the flooding issues. We've had upwards of 40 flooding events in the last several decades. Well over a dozen have been situations where the water's gone over the banks. And again, largely because of the Rockwild Channel.
One of the places, well, close to my house, that I've gotten to watch Johnson Creek flood rather dramatically is right near your office, actually. There is a bridge that goes between your office and the Mill End store. And I remember in 96, actually, I was about to buy some fabric, and I go down to the Mill End store, and there's about 2 feet of water at the doorway of the store. And I was amazed, and I just kept going down every day and watching that water rise. And it was basically this tiny little peninsula that was all that was left of the point between Johnson Creek and its confluence with the Willamette. But, I mean, that's a place where that rock work you're talking about is very apparent.
Yeah, it's very apparent there, and I think it's important to realize that that flooding event at the place that you were looking at it, that's within the Willamette floodplain. And so you were having the Willamette backing up as well as Johnson Creek being a flashy stream coming together at that point. In fact, our offices were filled with 2 feet of water at that time, which is why we do not have carpet on the floor today. It's a painted cement floor, so that in the event that we do have a flooding event, everything just comes up, we walk away, and we come back and mop up the mess. I think one of the things that the dialogue is getting at is there's been a huge shift in values. You know, back in the 30s, the value was to use bricks and mortar, and you even unfortunately see that today with the big pipe, to solve our problems. And today there's been a huge shift to say we can use natural functions to restore floodplain, to restore habitat, even going beyond that to protect and preserve the habitat that we have. Within the Johnson Creek watershed, we still have some of the largest upland forest areas that are terrific habitat for coyotes, for birds, for a variety of other species. But I think what we're seeing today is a huge shift in values about the way we want to treat our environment, and that is not necessarily with bricks and mortar and cement.
Well, now, if I could interject a comment.
You can after I do a station ID.
Okay.
But I want people to know that you're listening to KBOL Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. We're talking about the urban creeks that run mostly underground in Portland today, but some of the ones like Johnson Creek that still enhance the natural areas in our city. And I'm joined by Michelle Boussard, who is the executive director of the Johnson Creek Watershed Council, Mike Houck, who is really wanting to talk, who is with the Urban Green Spaces Institute, and Bob Salinger with the Audubon Society of Portland. And now, Mike, you're on.
Mike Houck is always wanting to talk. Well, no, I wanted to connect the dots between Bob and Michelle's comments and actually your opening piece, and that is the term green infrastructure was used a couple times at least during the intro, and Michelle's comment about shifting attitudes is right on. When I started at Portland Audubon Society in 1980 on urban wildlife issues, I was told to know in certain terms by local professional planners that there was no place for nature in the city, that if I really wanted to focus on wildlife, fish and wildlife habitat, I should go out into the rural hinterlands. That the state land use planning program was not designed to protect nature in the city. It was designed to protect farm and forest land outside that magical, that icon, the urban growth boundary. And fortunately, over the intervening 26 years, attitudes have shifted, and we have gotten into a mode, although in my opinion we have a long ways to go with respect to regulatory programs and the planning program, truly addressing urban natural resource issues. At least there is a recognition that the green infrastructure, the streams and the forests that support the health of those streams, are in fact a legitimate part of the infrastructure in the city and the metropolitan region. That has been a dramatic shift over the last 26 years. As I said, we have a ways to go, but I think we're headed in the right direction, recognizing that, for example, in the case of Johnson Creek, the city of Portland has expended a lot of federal money, FEMA money, to buy portions of the floodplain and actually remove houses and reestablish the floodplain with Johnson Creek, recognizing that's far cheaper to use that green infrastructure than to pay for the bricks and mortar that Michelle was referring to.
Or to pay for rebuilding houses.
Correct.
That are flooded out all the time. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. We're talking this morning with Michelle Bouchard. Let me get your name right. Michelle. Try it again.
Yeah, that's okay. I was called Michael Buzzer the first day of seventh grade.
I've been watching you wince every time I said your name. So tell me how to pronounce your name appropriately.
It's Boussard.
Boussard. Michelle Boussard. Mike Houck with the Urban Green Spaces Institute, and Bob Salinger with Portland Audubon Society. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. This is Locus Focus, a whole communities radio project special. I wanted to get back to kind of connecting between the importance of what Mike was just saying of protecting and enhancing our green infrastructure and this notion that maybe the bricks and mortar and cement approach is passé. Bob, you were talking about the big pipe both on Kayleen's piece and since then in life here, and I wonder, why are we doing the big pipe if there's this realization that green solutions maybe last longer and be a whole lot less expensive?
That's a great question, and I think the big pipe has really driven home for many, many people that may not have been aware of it, the economic importance of protecting green infrastructure. And As I noted, the big pipe, we're putting in the big pipe because the city of Portland was sued under the Clean Water Act because there was raw sewage going down the river, and the city settled and agreed to put in a big pipe. But at that time, back in the 90s, there were two paths that the city could have taken. The first would have been a lot cheaper, and it was certainly considered, and that was to do a smaller pipe, take a longer period of time, and spend the savings, or at least part of the savings, on green infrastructure. Because green infrastructure can serve exactly that same purpose. It can deal with the stormwater that's causing the current pipes to overflow and put the sewage into the river. At that time, the regulatory agencies, the litigants, were not confident enough in that kind of approach or that the city would follow through to agree to go that route. It would have been cheaper, it would have been more effective, and it would have had multiple benefits. Not only would you have gotten the sewage out of the river, but we would have greened up our landscape and served wildlife, served people in a much, much more broader way. But the fact that we're now spending $1.4 billion on this project has served as a wake-up call and reminded the city that we need to start pursuing these green solutions. As I noted on the introduction, if we don't do that, the big pipe will be obsolete within a couple of generations. And if we had done these kind of solutions 30 and 40 years ago, if we'd started doing green infrastructure 30 or 40 years ago, we wouldn't be spending $1.4 billion today. So to that end, the City of Portland Bureau of Environmental Services has a watershed services program that works exactly on these green issues. And they've developed a management plan, it's a citywide management plan that calls for things like eco-roofs, bioswales, daylighting creeks, restoring floodplains, restoring the tree canopy. It's modeled the entire city, not just the stream corridors, but the entire city, and look for what we can do, what will be the most effective solutions on every part of the landscape to serve multiple objectives, not only clean water, but habitat, biodiversity. And it's very, very exciting stuff. The City of Portland adopted it unanimously in March. They funded the program this year. That's a program that's seen cuts in prior years. And they created a watershed enhancement fund, which is a new part of the funding package. And I think perhaps most importantly, and we'll see if they follow through, but to date, things look good. The city committed in adopting this plan to considering watershed principles in every single project it does, rather than just picking out individual projects and pursuing them periodically across the landscape. Instead, at the start of every single project, the city will consider what it can do to restore green infrastructure. So whether they're putting in a road, a new housing development, you name it, they're going to think about these issues at the front end. And I think that's a way to really transform the landscape very quickly.
So what would this landscape look like with what you guys call a green infrastructure, as opposed to, well, we all know what the big pipe looks like as it's going in, and what it sounds like for that matter?
Well, first of all, we should make it very clear to your listeners, nobody's advocating that we not do a big pipe. Bob's point was we need to do that in addition. We have to do that because of the way we have changed the landscape, in addition to the green solution. So nobody's saying don't do the big pipe. It was a matter of how we did it and over what period of time.
Also, I think it was also there was a question of whether the big pipe had to go in on the east side. I think when I was first talking to you guys a number of years ago, there was still some talk about maybe having more enhancing the wetlands on the east side more.
Well, the pipe had to go on both sides. There was definitely the Bob's point was that we had the potential for capturing as much as $300 million to spend on restoration on the main stem of the Willamette, on Johnson Creek, on Balch Creek, and other tributaries to the Willamette. Unfortunately, and we should make it clear too, the city wanted to take that approach. It turned out they were not allowed to by the agencies, and there were a couple conservation groups that wanted to go ahead and take the big pipe approach. So I think it's important to get that out there, that the city really did want to at that time to do what we consider to be the right thing. With respect to your question about how would the landscape look different, one thing is we need to protect and restore what we have still above ground. The way the landscape would look different, in my opinion, would be that when you see buildings going in Portland, whether it's South Waterfront, whether it's Portland State University expansion, no matter where it is in the city, you should be seeing green, green, green. Retrofits on the streets. If you go to Southwest 12th and Montgomery, for example, at Portland State, you'll see four really very nice-looking cells, bioswales, where water, in fact, I went out there one day during a 2-inch rain event. All of that water from that section of that street was infiltrated into the ground. We should see a lot more green that's integrated with the built environment. I think that would be the most significant change in the landscape that we should see.
And just to paint a picture for a second for your listeners, from the natural to the more urban, on the natural end of it, there is a project that BES was able to do, Bureau of Environmental Services was able to do, where Kelly Creek, which is one of the highest priority reaches in Johnson Creek for spawning salmon, we know that we've got coho in that reach, they were able to leverage their resources and literally re-meander Kelly Creek and put large wood in there, which creates the cool pools and the shading that the fish need, plant it with trees that will, you know, grow well beyond our lifetime to create the kind of canopy that stretch will look as natural as it did probably 100 years ago. To the other end of the spectrum, at along Knapp and Rex, between about 20th and 22nd Avenues Southeast, they've gone in, BES has gone in, and put pavers down that will actually allow the stormwater to seep right down into the asphalt road. There's grass growing up between these little brick pavers. Looks like, you know, red ribbons on either side of otherwise asphalt road. And again, as Mike was saying, you're already starting to see the improvement in the way stormwater is being treated in the urban environment. Just, you know, two ends of the spectrum of what green infrastructure is going to look like if we just keep pursuing the kinds of projects that we're pursuing, in addition to the big pipe.
Actually, I bicycle over those that permeable surfaces.
Yeah.
I think it's on Malden, Rex or Malden down there. There's two streets that have it, and one is the street, I guess it's, maybe it's Rex, that goes...
Well, there's three. I think there's Knapp, Rex, and Malden all
right, and yeah, I think it's Knapp actually to go down. Knapp is all, the whole area for about two blocks is those little pavers, and then one of the cross streets just has them for the parking area. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting look. It's a strange bicycle experience. You kind of have to get used to, like, the level. It reminds me of the old Hawthorne Bridge with the wooden sidewalks. But it's pretty impressive, and I've actually, that's an area that in 96 was flooding very badly, actually. So,
well, an interesting thing, by the way, is that, as Bob said earlier, these kinds of projects, the project that Michelle is describing, are multi-objective if they're done right. And my favorite example that I've seen is on Northeast Siskiyou. There's a curb extension where, again, the Bureau of Environmental Services went in, pilot project, extended the curb in kind of a crescent shape out from the curb on both sides of Northeast Siskiyou, and planted it with mostly native vegetation, rushes, and so forth. And again, they left little slots where the water could run from the street into these little bioswales where they could infiltrate at least the smaller storm events. The interesting thing about that is that system, which improves the treatment of stormwater in the city, is also a wonderful and beautiful looking traffic calming device for that neighborhood. And the interesting thing is adjacent neighborhoods have been coming to the city actually offering to buy, to pay, to put these kinds of curb extensions into their neighborhood because it looks nice, it calms traffic, and it allows that neighborhood to take responsibility for managing some of its stormwater.
And so then it kind of, again, it looks like what Michelle was saying earlier about the whole idea of the difference between having our waterways and our transportation ways being freeways versus being these meanders. And it seems like people want to meander through their neighborhoods. They want to get off of that fast track. I remember when Steve Johnson was here last year, he talked about the slow water movement that he wants to call for, kind of like the slow food movement. But I think that's a very interesting thought, the thing about how the water just rushes through. I mean, and I know we've got some callers, and we're about to get to the call, so just hang on there for just another moment. But there's a place where I bicycle between my house and here where I pass by these storm sewers, and I get a heavy odor of sewage every summer. I just noticed it for the first time yesterday, and I remembered it last summer, too. And I'm wondering what is we're sort of in a dry period, but I'm wondering what would be causing the sewage odor to be coming up through storm sewers, which should be just for storm water. Is that an example of our combined overflow system not doing too well? Everybody's just thinking very quickly. We might take phone calls while you guys mull that.
Maybe somebody from BES can call in.
Okay.
You know, one of the things I just want to add, when we think about what this green infrastructure would look like, you know, it takes so many different layers and so many different partners and so much leadership. Bureau of Environmental Services has certainly provided a lot of that leadership in the Comprehensive Watershed Management Plan. But, you know, another really important player in this is Metro. And if it wasn't for some of the investments that Metro has made, you wouldn't be able to stand atop Hogan Butte, which is the epicenter of Johnson Creek watershed, and look out on a vast canopied landscape. So I just want to add that in order to have this vision of green infrastructure that we want, it takes so many partners and so many players and huge investments.
And regional planning and a regional government.
Here, here.
Okay. So if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 12 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO. This is the Whole Communities Radio Project, a special here on Locus Focus. I'm joined by, let's see, I get your name right, Michelle Bouzard. Hey, Mike Houck and Bob Salinger. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call again at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air. Let's see if our caller is actually there. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is there any chance of restoring Brooklyn Creek, which runs sort of alongside Southeast 17th, and it used to empty into a pond where the old gas tanks were north of Powell, and then it would empty into the Willamette River. And I thought it would be really neat if they could dig up Brooklyn Creek.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, in my opinion, unfortunately, first of all, daylighting is not an inexpensive venture. Most of the daylighting that will occur, I suspect, will come about through redevelopment, where we have a situation where there's low-density development and there's a decision made. For example, South Waterfront is probably the best example today, where the money that becomes available through that redevelopment, through tax increment financing and so forth, could be used to create that what would be an amenity within that redevelopment project. It's unlikely that streams such as the caller just referred to would be daylighted without some kind of nexus with a redevelopment project. That's just a reality, I think.
Well, they do have a big hole where those gas tanks used to be, so if they could find out where they put the water, maybe they could at least fill that up and have a nice little pond there.
Of course, if there were gas tanks there, the first thought that comes to my mind is, do we have a mini Superfund site?
Well, the gas tanks are gone.
Yeah.
But what went into the ground, I think, because the gas tanks probably leaked as well. Actually, which kind of gets me to the thought about South Waterfront. Bill Bakke got me very sentimental about Markham Creek when he took me on the Markham Creek tour a few years ago. And we walked to this. It was at that time just a cyclone fence with a big sign that said, do not enter, or road closed, or something like that. And that was the beginning of the South Waterfront development site. So I know that South Waterfront is built on this it's a confluence of a lot of, like, little distributaries that come off of Markham Creek, and I think some other creeks also flow in there. Was an amazing wetland. So my fantasy was, well, why can't we return at least part of that area to natural wetland and restore this really rich wildlife habitat that was historically there on the Willamette? And I asked Gil Kelly, the planning director, about, well, why aren't you going to daylight Markham Creek? And he kind of rolled his eyes like it's an environmental nightmare. So let's talk a bit about why some areas. Why is Markham Creek not getting daylighted, for instance?
Well, I'd like to get back to the caller's question first, though. Let's not be too I didn't want to sound dismissive of it. They're just realities in terms of funding. I think the secret for places like Brooklyn Creek, is that what you called it?
Yeah.
Would be for people in that neighborhood to actually become aware that there is a stream there. And there have been some pretty neat programs throughout the country where people have actually put banners or signs in the sidewalks or any number of techniques that, first of all, let people know there is a stream down there. And I think over time, once there's a critical mass of interest in that neighborhood to recognize that there is a stream down there, then I think the potential for actually doing some of that daylighting work is much greater. We need to create awareness first. That's why the disappearing streams map that was referred to in the opening segment has been so powerful a tool. Once that map got out there, people could actually visualize where those underground streams were. And so my advice to the caller would be, you know, it sounds like you may already know where the stream course is. If not, the Bureau of Environmental Services can certainly tell you where the stream course is and take on a community project with City Repair or any number of these local nonprofits, friends groups, and create a Friends of Brooklyn Creek to start publicizing the fact that there's a stream there. So that'd be my immediate response.
And then raise the money to daylight it.
And it can be done. I mean, there is one example in Portland going on right now at the Winkler development in southwest Portland, where they're daylighting a tributary of Tryon Creek. And this is basically a developer that's putting up a whole lot of housing units and decided he wanted a creek running through the middle of it and daylighted a creek. It's going to be a relatively short stretch, but that's where it begins, as Mike said, with redevelopment. And, you know, that development is financing that project.
Oh, actually,
it is possible to do it.
I know that one of the people that you work with a bit, Jill Figlister, who's with the Coalition for Livable Future, I mean, I've been at her backyard, and it slopes downward, and there's all these trees growing in there, and I know somebody who lives on the other side of what is obviously a creek. And actually, a guy I know who lives on the other side was talking several years ago about trying to daylight that creek. I'm not sure which one it is, but it flows just south of Powell, and it's up around 39th, and it heads probably down. I'm not sure if it's Holgate Creek, but whatever. But there's these places. I mean, there's a place where there's these very long backyards, not in a good example of urban density at all, but very nice places to live. And that it's just clear when you see the kind of tree lines in these little ravines that do dot parts of southeast Portland, you just know that there are creeks there.
I think one of the places we have a real opportunity to daylight creeks actually is along the industrial area on Highway 30, because a lot of those forest park streams do not connect to the river. The last stretch is underground. In fact, all of them really, for the most part. And I think those are great opportunities as that area gets redeveloped to start to connect those. And when we talk about biodiversity, we haven't spent a lot of time on that today. I think it's really important to note what a key role these things do play. It's not just, you know, that we'll have songbirds in our backyard. That's important. But in terms of preserving biodiversity, there was a study done by Smart Growth America that talked about the fact that we have over 6,500 imperiled species in the United States. 60% of those are found in urban areas, and 30% of those are found only in urban areas. So from a wildlife perspective, whether it's fish or birds, mammals, it's critical that we start to make that connectivity. And the best way to do it is along streams.
Yes, Mike?
Yes, I want to go back to Michelle's point earlier about Metro's role in all of this. Your callers should understand that there is one of the most significant, the most important environmental measures coming up in the next year and for the next decade or more is the Natural Areas, Parks, and Streams bond measure that would raise $227.4 million to protect existing resources, but very importantly, and also provide funding for local parks. So $168 million would go to Metro for acquiring these large ecologically significant areas. $15 million would go to the City of Portland. $44 million to local park providers, 15 of which would go to City of Portland for its priorities, including Johnson Creek, by the way. Johnson Creek and the Columbia Slough and the Willamette River are all on the regional target areas as well as the City of Portland's priorities. But there's a new fund of $14 million called the Nature and Neighborhoods Opportunity Grants Program, which would be available for nonprofit organizations and local park providers to go in and re-green nature-deficient neighborhoods. So we have an opportunity to not only, as Michelle was saying earlier, we're trying to work along the entire spectrum from the absolutely natural to the very hardcore urban. And this bond measure will provide $14 million to go in and re-green areas that are now deficient of these areas for things like rain gardens, community gardens, eco-roofs, and so on and so forth. So I really want to emphasize to your callers that they're interested in the topic we're discussing today. Passing that bond measure is one of the highest priorities we could possibly have in the next year. And I'll just give a quick website reference, www.urbanfauna.org. Go to that website, and there's a lot of information they can get on how to become actively involved in passing that bond.
And so it'll be a good time for Friends of Brooklyn Creek to get started.
Right.
So I think it's actually a very good suggestion for the caller and for others who know of underground streams in your neighborhood to form a Friends of that group. I had a kind of uncanny experience several years ago. I was back visiting my hometown in Massachusetts, and there's a legendary Blackstone River that flows culverted under my hometown, and it was a strange, it was sort of a sad thing when I was growing up to like know that there was a river in my town, but it was underground and I could never see it. And a number of years ago, I was back visiting, and I saw these banners along like sort of the edge of downtown that said Blackstone River, and it's kind of what Michael was describing. And I got really excited, and I got to see where the path was, and I figured that some of the things I'd kind of guessed about it were actually right. And then I was back a couple years later, and the banners were down, so much for the Friends of Blackstone River.
But we can't lose hope in the signage piece of it, because if you name a place and you bring it to people's awareness, it's amazing the changes that can be made. When I started with the council, there were less than a dozen signs that said, you are in the Johnson Creek watershed. And to me, that's as powerful as a city limit sign. Today, we've been able to put upwards of 35 watershed boundary signs up telling people, this is your place. This is your watershed. And I think, as Mike suggested, when you name a place, that can be a very powerful awareness building
community tool. And we got some more callers. If you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
I'm curious. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm curious about, do pipes underground in cities and cement and asphalt above, does that create a rat problem in cities? And also, do rats only support unhealthy environments? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. I don't know. Anybody have any thoughts? Talking about the fauna, urban fauna.
Certainly, rats use sewer pipes and come out of them. You can find rats in both natural areas and in highly urbanized areas. A lot of times it has to do, you know, with the actual habits of the landscape management. You know, are there things that specifically track them, open garbage, accessible compost, those kinds of things. But it probably contributes.
Mm-hmm.
Natural environment, there's going to be more predators on them, for one thing, and that'll control them.
Cat, actually, we found a huge rat waiting for us at the bottom of the back steps, which the cat had nicely killed for us. And that's the first rat I've ever seen in Portland that was that size. But I know that Bob has some strong feelings about outdoor cats, but that cat did a service to Selwood, I think.
Well, you know, I think to follow up with Michelle and also with the caller, though, I think one of the things that educating people about the creeks that are there does is remind people that what we do in our backyards affect the river and affects the creeks, even if we don't see them, that, you know, our personal habits have a direct impact on our water quality. And so it's not just daylighting them that's important, but understanding how our own personal habits have an impact on the landscape. And people don't usually connect that. They don't think that if they're a mile from the river, what they do in their backyard, whether they use pesticides, what they flush down their toilets, how they maintain their vehicles, if they even have vehicles, impacts the river directly.
Yeah, actually, I was interviewing Sam Adams for a documentary we'll be airing at the end of this month about some of these subjects. And I think I kind of put these words in his mouth because from what he was saying, but he came out with a statement I really loved, that we have to start thinking of the streets in Portland as the tributaries of the Willamette River. And he was talking about the runoff problems. And I think that that's
right,
a really good way to think.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And let's talk a bit more about how are the streets tributaries, and if they are tributaries, what can we do to make the streets cleaner tributaries to the Willamette?
Well, I think the paving project that we talked about earlier is certainly one example where you're really emphasizing the use of permeable pavers in your urban streets as you can go back and retrofit them. But increasingly where, as you know, Bob and Mike have said, you've got redevelopment happening, you've got an opportunity to do green streets with permeable paving. The other piece of it, though, I think, is what Bob said, changing people's habits on those streets they drive and bike on, is just stopping from that flick of a whatever piece of garbage that could well end up in Johnson Creek or one of the other creeks. What that ends up doing is creating a habitat for fish that's, like throwing garbage around your own home. So it's not just what you drive on, it's what you're doing when you're doing that driving.
Actually, I was thinking of another quote. I'm sort of doing previews of my documentary about Leslie Paul Kaspar, who's the director of the Portland Community Gardens. And she actually, I read this quote that she had in some national magazine that was online, so I had a call up and say, I got to have this quote on audio. But she said that we've got to start thinking of the city as our own garden. She was talking about city gardens, but just if we thought of the whole city as a garden that we tend, then the city would be a garden. And I thought that was a really kind of nice thought.
Well, there's actually a book that I've quoted the author of, Ann Whiston Spurn, for about the last 25 years. I was very fortunate to take a class from her at MIT a couple years ago. She wrote a book called, and I would really suggest to your listeners that they might want to check this book out. It's called The Granite Garden, and it spoke specifically to that view, and it's a wonderful book.
Actually, sort of an aside, I received a book here a couple of weeks ago called Gardens in Wartime or something like that, and it's very interesting. It's about all these gardens that are built in war zones, and shows gardens that are built in the trenches in World War I, and it makes you think about how important gardens are and how much it resonates with us. And I think if we can go one more step besides like cultivating flowers and vegetables to think about, because the Native Americans, when they ran this place, I mean, they basically did run this place. I mean, they were gardening the entire landscape, and they did it through fire, and they did it through different kinds of harvesting of berries and medicinal food, and probably managing the wildlife by culling it for hunting. And I think that if we could think of our whole relationship to the landscape in terms of the gardeners, it would probably be a much healthier way than what we think about ourselves now.
Well, and the term rain garden is so wonderful, and that is being used pretty pervasively around the city right now, the idea of capturing and turning rain, and Bob mentioned the watershed plan that was recently adopted unanimously by Portland City Council that the Bureau of Environmental Services produced. And in that, they make a very explicit statement that's the most important element of that plan. Stormwater is a valuable resource, not a problem to be gotten rid of, to be put in pipes and sent away. And getting back to your street question, though, and flowing to the Willamette, in case any of your listeners are skeptical about how much impact we can actually have on the stormwater management, on the environment, in the city, in the hardcore, the build-up area. We all know that these hard or impervious surfaces collect stormwater, and more or less it goes directly to the local stream or the river. By landscaping differently, by creating these rain gardens, by using green street techniques, increasing the urban forest canopy, getting more trees out there along the streets, we can actually, even though there is a lot of hard surface out there, reduce what's referred to as the effective imperviousness. In other words, what the river and the stream actually feels. And it is possible by greening up our buildings, especially as we redevelop, to dramatically decrease the impact of impervious surfaces on the rivers and streams.
I also wonder, I mean, one of the things that seems to be a growing movement here is people in their parking strips planting gardens of some sort or other. A lot of them are native flower gardens, some are vegetable gardens, and getting rid of just those grass strips. And I'm wondering, is that helpful? I mean, is it better to have a lot of native plants growing between the sidewalk and the street rather than just having a strip of grass?
It's certainly helpful for wildlife value, and I think for also aesthetics as well. I heard an amazing thing the other day. It just blew me away, from the Office of Sustainability. They were talking about if we put eco-roofs on top of all the warehouses in the southeast industrial area, we could lower the ambient temperature of that area by a full degree. So, you know, in this heat wave that we're having and with all the concern about global warming in general, I mean, it also has a variety of effects for the environment, not just for the water quality.
I will testify, because I bicycled yesterday, and I bicycled a couple of days ago when it was really hot. And coming back from Cebu, back into Sellwood, it's like you cross Powell heading south, the temperature drops about 1 degree. And then you get to the border of Oaks Bottom, and it drops about 5 degrees. I mean, it's when you're outside and you're really, and especially on your bike, so you're going pretty fast, and you kind of really notice the change pretty dramatically. And I think it's a real, especially when you're going along Oaks Bottom, you notice this is what happens when you have greenery and you have access to the river and everything is interplaying. And the other thing, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said, I also noticed that in the winter it's not as cold down in Sellwood as it is in the... Yeah, it's because water and greenery, they kind of keep the temperature extremes from being quite so... And I think that's also, it's like the slow water movement. I guess it could be the slow temperature movement as well. We wouldn't have to have these rapid, dramatic increases and decreases in temperature if we had ways of absorbing the shock effect of it all.
Well, and actually that, of course, relates to air quality as well. Urban heat island effect, the hotter it is, the more ozone, the more pollutants that are going to be in the air through that interaction of that toxic mixture combined with higher temperatures. So again, we're talking about only water quality, but air quality as well.
Yeah, I noticed also as I was over in this part of town, in the industrial southeast, that there was this haze along the south horizon. And I thought, I couldn't tell if it was clouds or pollution. It was rather alarming, actually. Oh, welcome to L.A. And then as I got close to Powell, actually south of Powell, I had a really good view of the skyline and the South Cascades, and it cleared up. So, I mean, that the air quality is that much better south of Powell than it is north of Powell, which I thought was a little alarming, actually.
You know, and it's not unlike what happens in Johnson Creek. Sorry to shift, but I've been thinking about, you know, the premise of your show, Disappeared Creeks. As you move through Johnston Creek and its system, when you get to places where there's good canopy and you've got good large wood debris in the creek, what you've got is clean, cool water that's good for the fish and the salmon. And one of the things I've been thinking about as you've been talking, as we think about disappeared creeks, those are nothing short of the ultimate fish passage barrier. And in Johnston Creek, we still have migrating salmon, and they are considered an indicator species. If salmon are present, then it tells you life is good. And if we can keep those values around clean, cool, clear, meandering creeks with good forest canopy, and we can start to see the fish coming back, I think it tells us our world is a little bit better place to be. One of the other pieces, I think, prevents us from, that's just all I want to say.
Okay, well, that's great. And actually, that was Michelle Bouzard, who is with the Johnston Creek Watershed Council. We also have Mike Houck with Urban Green Spaces Institute and Bob Salinger with the Audubon Society of Portland. We're talking, as Michelle just mentioned, about disappeared creeks this morning. And if you want to join in the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 26 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBOO. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. I heard that there is the very large 8,000 people meeting in Vancouver, B.C. about urban matters, of which I've heard absolutely zero. Absolutely no comment on the radio, TV, or in the newspapers. Is there anything that's going on up there that has any relevance to Portland?
There certainly is. In fact, I was at that meeting. I was at a previous meeting, actually. There were a number of meetings in Vancouver, B.C., which is certainly an urban environment that we should be emulating more. Of course, they're quite interested in what we're doing. In fact, one of the conversations I had with planners in Vancouver was that they wanted to learn more about and share information with what Portland is doing and vice versa. And, of course, Seattle's in that mix as well. There was a World Urban Forum. Prior to that, there was the Canadian Landscape Architecture professional meeting. That happened to be the one that I was at. But there was also an architecture meeting. There was a planners meeting. There were all kinds of meetings a week or two ago. And by the way, the mayor of Vancouver announced publicly during that meeting that Vancouver would accept 2 million new residents as their commitment to creating a sustainable environment in British Columbia. That being that rather than having those people spreading across the landscape, that Vancouver was going to do everything in its power to ensure that those people were actually living in Vancouver. But the quid pro quo along with that was the protection and restoration of their green infrastructure. And one of the meetings I attended in Vancouver, by the way, was a charrette, a planning charrette with 200 people. Interestingly, there were a lot of folks from around the world attending the International Urban Forum. World Urban Forum.
I think this is part of the World Social Forum. It was one of the regional meetings.
Right. And this charrette was amazing because Patrick Condon, who's a landscape architect who urges us to build our cities lighter, greener, cheaper, smarter, who's a good friend of mine and has helped us a lot down here with respect to developing a different philosophy about how to manage our stormwater, created a map that's about 40 feet high by 60 feet wide, 60 feet long, broke it up into squares, and those 300 people actually sat down over the course of an entire day and actually indicated where you would need to put what kind of housing to accommodate those 2 million people, but also outline the green infrastructure that needs to be protected and restored as a part. So it's a two-part effort that they're engaged in up there. We're trying to do the same thing here, by the way. They aren't that far ahead of us. In fact, I think from an ecological perspective, we've got a leg up on Vancouver. But from an urban design perspective, if you look at North and South False Creek, if you look at the Coal Harbor and the towers that are going in that are accommodating those people with excellent urban design, They do have, I think, a leg up on us from the design perspective.
Well, they definitely want to build high. I mean, it's debatable. I haven't been to Vancouver in 5 years, but I was shocked. I hadn't been there in about 15 years before that. And it depends on what part of Vancouver you're in, whether, I know, because I talked to the anti-smart growth people here a few years ago who use Vancouver as their example of the worst kind of urban development.
I couldn't disagree more.
I'm talking about Mel Zucker, some of your friends. I don't agree with them either. But I think that I can see some of the places where people can pick apart what's going on in Vancouver.
Sure.
Because there's some things about it. I mean, I have mixed feelings about it. And I think that some of the tower, as I drove through some of the areas where all those towers have gone up, and it doesn't feel that much different than Seattle. You have this very high landscape, and you've kind of lost that sense of the connection between the ground and the sky. And I mean, Vancouver was my favorite city in the world in the 70s, and it's not recognizable anymore. And I know that they are doing a good job of squeezing people in, but I think someone like Mel Zucker would say, well, they're squeezing people in, and that's, do you want to squeeze people in? So,
well, I walked around a lot that whole week, and I can tell you that especially North and South Falls Creek and Cole Harbor, we talk about how progressive Portland is. You know what the setback on the Willamette River is for development is in Portland?
50 feet.
25 feet. You go to Vancouver, and I paced it off. It's in some places 700 feet, close to a quarter mile setback from the water line to those buildings. So I'd say there's a pretty decent trade-off there from height to protection of more of the waterfront.
I would also say that I think there's a history there, because I was hanging out in Vancouver in the early 70s, and you'd spend the day at English Bay Beach. I mean, that's like right almost downtown, and it was a beach you could go swimming at.
Right.
And a beautiful it's the strait, but it almost was like the ocean. And then Kitsilano Beach, which would be the equivalent, I'm trying to think of a neighborhood in Portland, because it's sort of on the way to the U District, but there is no neighborhood in Portland. I mean, it'd be kind of like if you brought Sobeys Island to the city in a way, but I mean, it's incredible beaches,
right.
And they have swimmable water right at the edge of the city. And so this is a legacy that they were able, I think that was the advantage they had, is they hadn't polluted their waterways quite the way that we've polluted the Willamette over the last 100 years.
And they have one freeway and a fabulous bus system. They're not perfect. We're not perfect. As I said, the fortunate situation for us is we still have the Johnson Creeks that form that green infrastructure that I think far exceeds what they have in Vancouver. So we still have the opportunity to combine both the better urban design and protection of what we have left.
And we're a smaller city.
And we are doing that. And again, I think it is indicative of the shift in values, whereas we only have a 25-foot setback on the Willamette, which is absolutely deplorable. In the upper watershed in the Pleasant Valley and Springwater planning areas, we've been able to successfully advocate for 200-foot riparian buffer zones up there. And that's happening as parallel to the development happening up there. And again, I think it's a really significant shift in what we value. I think another important shift showing what we value is we talk about disappearing streams. Disappearing streams disappear into ponds as well, which are lovely landscape features in your backyard, but they're absolutely horrific for water temperature. And if we can move some of those ponds that people value, and I understand that they value, off channel and get the creek going back into the channel it's supposed to be in, again, we'll have a way to improve the habitat, not only for all the wildlife and the fish, but I think for the people as well.
So are you saying that people should get rid of their little backyard ponds?
I'm not saying they should get rid of their little backyard ponds, but I think that they should take a page out of our book. We're working with property owners in the upper watershed where they have agreed to take their lovely backyard pond off channel.
So what does that mean exactly?
It's a heavy-duty construction process where the pond will be recreated off the main stem of the creek moving through there. The creek will find its own meander again, will feed the offline pond, but that hot water will not be feeding the creek as it is presently and will not be the barrier into which the creek disappears again.
I think a really good example of improving an area along Johnson Creek is what Reed College has done in its canyon, where they had the Crystal Springs, which is a tributary to the Johnson Creek, mm-hmm. and it was dammed up, and I guess it was kind of like a swimming pool. And
yes, it was a swimming pool.
Yeah, lovely swimming pool. I mean, it was an amenity to read. Well, I think
no one used it at Reed.
Right. Well, it was actually full of pond scum, as I recall. It was rather grody, and I took a walk along that area. Well, I've walked along that area many, many times, but I took a walk with Bill Bakke again a few years ago, and they were just starting the restoration, mm-hmm. and there was a huge amount of erosion, and there was hardly anything growing, and there was algae bloom everywhere, and it was a mess. Then I was back after they took the dam out, and it's amazing what's going on there, and they're really doing some major work in restoring the canyon. It's a little aside. If Reed College could put as much, it could value as much the community garden that they want to put a dorm over as they are valuing the canyon, and they could see the connection between what's going on in that garden and what's going on in the canyon, I think it would say that much more for their appreciation of protecting the watershed.
And I think one of the words she used is really important, connectivity. Just west of the Reed Canyon, and you can stand there and you don't know that you're in the city, but just west of that restoration project on the golf course, the council, PGE, and Bureau of Environmental Services actually daylighted Crystal Springs there. And PGE brought in its heavy equipment, moved the culvert out of the way. Today, it is a thriving wetland, and as Bob earlier said, it is an absolute picture of biodiversity there. You've got salamanders coming back to that area. It's a joy to work down
so
in that
this
area.
This is the area between like the rhododendron garden and the golf course?
Yeah, you've got the rhododendron garden, you've got Reed College, and you've got the golf course. And you've got some of the highest producing cold water streams in that area moving into Johnson Creek through the Crystal Springs system there.
And I've also noticed that Crystal Springs has stopped backing up into Bybee, as it used to for so many years.
Right.
Before we continue, I actually got to let people know that coming up on KBOO this morning at 9, it's Movie Talk with Ed, Don, and DK, reviewing the latest movies. At 9:30, Laurie Sonnenfeld hosts Speaking of Animals. She'll talk with Nancy Perry of the Humane Society about stopping the slaughter of wild horses, the local lawsuit filed last week to stop the killing of cougars in Oregon, and Japan's takeover of the International Whaling Commission. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Robert Scholl, director of the regulatory policy for OMB Watch, about efforts to create an appointed federal sunset commission that could eliminate literally any federal program. At 9:30, hear part one of the lecture by journalist Amira Haas, the first Israeli reporter to live in Gaza, on From Occupation to Enclosure, Fragmenting the Palestinian State. And at 11 o'clock, Democracy Now! Goes to the Gaza to speak with a Palestinian physician, a former Israeli foreign minister, and a Palestinian activist, and to Afghanistan to speak with journalists about one of the bloodiest months there since the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. And you're listening to Locus Focus. I have with me this morning Michelle Buzard, who is with the Johnson Creek Watershed Council, Mike Houck with Urban Green Spaces Institute, and Bob Salinger with the Audubon Society of Portland. We're talking about reappearing the disappeared creeks. There was 388 miles of disappearing streams or disappeared streams here in Portland. And we've got a few minutes left. If you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. I think we've got some callers hanging on. So, hello, you're on the air.
Hello, am I on the air?
You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up, a couple years ago, there was that Healthy Streams Initiative, and I remember I was living in Multnomah Village, and there was a huge backlash against it when homeowners were required to put in like native plants, and there was like a whole movement and response to that. It was kind of around the time of Measure 7 and stuff, and I was wondering if your guests could talk to that and maybe try to explain how to avoid some of that reaction to what they see as kind of a government stepping in on what they consider their private property rights.
It certainly has been a challenge, I think, to get new regulations through. We're in an anti-regulatory climate, but it is terribly important. And Portland Healthy Streams did go down in flames. Nonetheless, I think if we're ultimately going to restore the landscape, regulations do have to be a piece of it. On the flip side, however, I think it's really important to note that we have tremendous opportunity in front of us right now. This is really a pivotal time in our history, and we have some amazing programs in place now that people need to take advantage of. And as Mike already mentioned, the bond measure is one huge opportunity, probably the biggest opportunity. But you also have things like the Portland Watershed Plan, the Office of Sustainability. There's a lot of funding out there. And so you know, I think it's a time where citizens, individuals, neighborhoods, the community can really take advantage of these things. And if people are interested in daylighting stream protecting habitat, they have some mechanisms right at their disposal. So I would encourage people not only to go out and vote for the bond measure in November, the green space bond measure, but also to really get involved with the city programs, with the metro programs, and learn about them. Because there's a lot of folks out there that can now help individuals in the community do these kinds of things. Things like daylighting Brooklyn Creek are not out of the realm of possibility anymore, and they probably were 10, 15 years ago. Now there's money there to do those things, and there's expertise to help.
And my response would be the city of Portland did not give up on the Healthy Streams initiative. They will be coming back with proposals to, and Bob is absolutely right, there's no way we can get away from the fact that some regulations are necessary to protect those public resources. And in fact, Measure 37, by the way, for those who are concerned about property rights, specifically exempts human health and safety and meeting federal law requirements such as Clean Water Act and Endangered Species Act. So there will be some program that will be brought forward from the city of Portland. And I would say that of all the polling that's been done statewide and throughout our region, the most important issue that citizens say they want is protection of water quality and protection of streams. My personal take on the backlash that occurred through the Healthy Streams Initiative is that it was a small but extremely vocal, a very small segment of our society, and that my advice to folks who are concerned about these issues is that they get involved and make sure City Council and Metro Council hears their concerns about the need to protect streams and water quality for the public good as opposed to specific individual property owners.
I think one of the challenges of Portland Healthy Streams, too, was that they took on the entire system at one time, and I think the city's come back and they're doing it in a more focused fashion. They're looking at different segments of the city and trying to tailor regulations to those segments of the city. And one of the things that's going on right now is the Bureau of Planning is looking at the north reach of the Willamette. And we talked for a few minutes about the Willamette and then kind of moved on to bigger opportunities. We don't need to accept a 25-foot setback along the Willamette. We don't need to accept the fact that we have these seawalls in place containing the river. There's a lot of other ways to do it, and South Waterfront stands as a great example. The setback isn't big enough, but it's not 25 feet either. It's 100 feet with an aspiration of 150, and that was done not through code, but through working with the development community and the people that are going to be moving in down there and trying to come up with different kinds of compromises to get there. But that's the kind of thing we ought to be aspiring to up and down the Willamette. We shouldn't accept the fact that we can't swim in it. That's just completely unacceptable. And as we go through these code review processes, it's critical that the public get involved. And particularly right now, I'd encourage people to get involved with the planning process for the North Reach, because that's exactly the kind of thing we're talking about. How big should the setbacks be? What kind of restoration should occur? And in there, we're asking, what should we ask of the business community in particular?
I also think people should spend some time down at Sellwood Riverfront Park and get a sense of what the river used to look like through most of Portland. And once you start to get a sense of the Willamette River as a live river that has a beach and banks and trees, I mean, it has cottonwood and willow forests right along the side of the river, and it's, I think, one of the nicest places to hang out in all of Portland. And as you're sitting there, you're realizing that the river used to be like this throughout all of the city. I mean, in various ways, wetland, which Oaks Bottom kind of replicates a bit of what was historically the wetlands that just lined the entire east side of the river. That might also help people to agitate a little bit more for returning the river to some more of a semblance. The same way with Johnson Creek. Unfortunately, the nicest stretch of Johnson Creek in the city right now is under construction to replace a sewer line that was a problem. I was just talking with Steve Johnson about he's still having problems with the city, but there's a stretch that you can enter it from 45th and Johnson Creek Boulevard. It's the Tideman Johnson Creek Nature Park. And it's a wonderful trail along Johnson Creek, which will open again in November. And the Springwater Corridor bike path goes through there. And it gives you an incredible sense of what Johnson Creek could be through the rest of Portland if maybe someday with enough redevelopment that will happen.
Well, and you're right. It is one of the most beautiful places along Johnson Creek. If you know the watershed I'll be rather arrogant, as well as I do. There are so many jewels along Johnson Creek. You can stand in some places in the upper watershed, and you just are transported out of the city. And I think it's not unlike when we name a place. When we get into a place, when we get our hands dirty, and we know that place intimately, it is a place we want to care for. One of the things that is so important to the council is our volunteer efforts, and we've all talked about the individual efforts we can make. Grassroots, individual responsibility for what we do to keep our city a garden and our creeks clean and cool is so important. On that note, I do have to make a plug for the Johnson Creek Watershed Council's Summer Watershed-Wide event. It's actually the first time we've ever done this. We're going to be working in the in-stream window. You don't want to be in a creek outside of that window because you would otherwise be disturbing important salmon habitat. But on July 15th, we will be working in four sites in the creek doing reconnaissance of fish passage barriers. We will be removing trash that create huge issues for the wildlife and fish in the creek. We'll be mulching existing plants. And doing some wetland plantings. But we do those events, we'll get 350 volunteers or more out, and once I think people touch the creek and it touches them, it creates a personal ethic that they want to follow through on. It's hard person by person, but whether you vote on the bond measure or you get in the creek and help us on July 15th, we need to instill that personal ethic in people for taking care of this place we all call home.
Right. I want to get back to Bob's comment about the role for the business community, because the reality is, in South Waterfront, for example, Homer Williams understood very clearly the nexus between the value of those condominiums going in and the presence of a wider greenway with a trail and a restored riverbank. And in fact, if you go into the Meriwether sales room, it's fascinating to me, because I sat on the planning committee for, God, 4 or 5 years battling over how wide that greenway should be, and there was a huge amount of resistance on the part of some of the property owners. Homer and some others, however, understood very clearly the same dynamic that's going on in Vancouver, B.C., and that is they're going to sell those condominiums for significantly more money with that wider greenway and a restored riverbank than had they not had it. So I think the business community is, in fact, beginning to understand the nexus between all of the issues we've been describing and the value of their product. It's amazing to me. I just came back from an urban park summit in Chicago. The private sector put $475 million into creating a park in downtown, a single park, Millennium Park, which is fabulous. The return on their investment, they've crunched the numbers, is $1.5 billion. We do not put enough value on our parks and trails and green space system in the city, in this region, and we need to start working with the business community to communicate that to the developers as well as the policymakers, because we're missing a bet here with regard to the true economic health of this region. The economic health of this region is tied directly to the issues we've been discussing.
I think we've got time for a couple more phone calls. We're just about out of time here. We've been talking about disappearing creeks in the Portland area and how to value the green infrastructure. I'm not sure if that's a term that Mike Houck made up, but he's certainly popularized it. And Mike Houck is one of our guests, along with Bob Salinger and Michelle Buzzard. And we have time for at least a couple more phone calls. So hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I am calling. I'm the property owner behind Jill Fuglitzer with a disappeared creek in my backyard. And I heard you talking about that earlier. I'm curious because myself and our neighbors are very interested in the process of daylighting and whether that's even a possibility. When I bought this house, we had to replace the sewer line, and it appears from the maps we saw that the sewer line actually connects to that old creek that's been buried. And so I'm wondering if that's even a possibility and where people start once you have the interest in the community behind you to do something like daylight it. Where do you go and how do you find out what the next steps are to do that?
I would contact the Bureau of Environmental Services. I hate to give out a specific name. Tom Lipton is their eco-roof guru and has done a huge amount of work with local developers and neighborhood folks with regard to taking on those kinds of efforts. But there are other people within the Bureau of Environmental Services that can provide advice to local neighborhood groups.
I think one of the nice things about the Watershed Management Plan is the entire city has now been modeled, and they can also tell you, I mean, daylighting streams is just one approach. What they can now tell you to some degree is what the most environmentally effective things you can do in each area of the city. And they have, it's a very small scale. And so basically they can say, you know, an eco roof would be the most effective thing here, or daylighting a creek would be the most effective thing, or removing non-native vegetation, both for water quality and for wildlife habitat. So it's a very sophisticated program, and daylighting the creek may not be the most effective way to go in any given area.
So actually where you're talking about, it just seems like a creek waiting to be freed behind your backyard. I'm not sure our caller is still there. I think we have time for one more caller. So, hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm shocked at the amount and type of new pollution that's going into the water by way of the oil that the utility poles are soaked in. The utility poles, you see a lot of new utility poles in the ground. They are using logs that are dipped in creosote oil. Creosote oil contains PCBs. You can smell these utility poles. You can see the ooze at the base of them shortly after they install them. Creosote is a highly toxic and carcinogenic chemical sludge that was created in the late 1800s to treat things like railroad ties. But we're living in more conscientious times, and I think, you know, we should put pressure on PGE to stop poisoning our groundwater. And a lot of utility poles are placed near street corners. The runoff from them is going to go into the gutters. As a pedestrian and cyclist, I hate the smell of them. They look ugly. They smell ugly. They're poisoning and polluting our environment.
Okay, and we're sort of out of time, so I've got to catch up. But thanks for calling. And so we got about one more moment for everybody to go around. I don't know if you want to respond to the utility poles or just have some closing thoughts about how we can protect our urban watersheds and the rest of the wildlife and nature in the city. Michelle?
I guess the point I'd like to make is going back to the layers that of partnerships that are required to restore our green infrastructure, and to make that an investment in the future, from the individual to the corporate. Everybody has a responsibility to create a personal and a corporate ethic around restoring our environment.
And Mike?
As Portland and the Portland-Vancouver region positions itself in the global economy, in my opinion, I'll just go back to the point that the economic health of the region is contingent upon our achieving the goals that we've been talking about today.
And Bob?
I think sometimes there's a cynicism out there about what we can really accomplish, and I would just reemphasize the fact that I think there's tremendous opportunity right before us, and probably the bond measure being the biggest thing in November. But take advantage of the opportunities out there. Learn about the programs that exist. They're pretty phenomenal.
And I'll just suggest get involved, and you can join the Johnson Creek Watershed wide event on July 15th. And Michelle, why don't you give a contact if people want to get more information about the event?
Call us at 652-7477, ask for Christine Steele or Greg Cianella, or check out our website, jcwc.org.
And the four sites, one is by your office?
It's going to be this from the mouth to our office, 45th Street Crossing that you mentioned earlier, Gresham Woods, and Kelly Creek.
And I want to thank Michelle Bouzard, Mike Houck, and Bob Salinger for joining me. This is a subject very close to my heart. Maybe we'll do another reunion a year from now, and we'll go out with some comments by Van Morrison.
Shoot for 6 months.
Okay.
Half a mile from the county fair, and the rain came pouring down. Me and Billy standing there with a silver half a crown. Had the full of fishing rod and the tackle on our backs. We just stood there getting wet with our backs against the fence. Oh, the water. Hope it don't rain all day. And it stung me to my soul. Stung me just like jelly roll, and it's stung me, yet it's stung me to my soul. Stung me just like going home, yet it's stung.
It's 9 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on the KBOO Radio Zine, it's Movie Talk with Ed, Don, and DK reviewing the latest movies. At 9:30, Lori Sonnenfeld, host, speaking of animals, she'll talk with Nancy Perry of the Humane Society for the latest updates on the fight to stop slaughter of wild horses, the local lawsuit filed last week to stop the killing of cougars in Oregon, and the story of Japan's takeover of the International Whaling Commission. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Robert Schull, Director of Regulatory Policy for OMB Watch, about efforts to create an appointed federal sunset commission that could eliminate literally any federal program. At 10:30, hear part one of a lecture by journalist Amira Haas, the first Israeli reporter to live in Gaza, on From Occupation to Enclosure, Fragmenting the Palestinian State. And at 11, Democracy Now! Goes to Gaza to speak with a Palestinian physician, a former Israeli foreign minister, and a Palestinian activist, and to Afghanistan to speak with journalists about one of the bloodiest months there since U.S.-led invasion in 2001.